This episode is brought to you by Ritual. Let's be real, our diets aren't always the most balanced this time of year. Oh, I'm still on Halloween candy, Alyssa.
Are you kidding? I like 2 paydays in my bag. Same. It's just, look, they have protein. They have
payday's
protein.
Healthy?
I think so.
I think it's healthy. Don't tell me it's not healthy.
Not now.
Listen, we know we're not getting all the vitamins we should get from the food that we're eating. Enter Ritual, the obsessively researched multivitamin.
Ritual's essential multis have the nutrients most of us don't get enough of from food, all in their clean, absorbable forms. No shady additives or ingredients that can do more harm to your body than good. And luckily, Ritual's Black Friday sale is here. That's great news.
You know what? When you get to be my age, I act like I'm super old, but I'm not. But when you get to be like a full-on adult, you got your feet under you, you've got like enough pans that you don't need to borrow them when you're making a roast. You know, like you're an adult.
Yes.
It's practical Christmas gifts are like good Christmas gifts. And I
actually think
I might gift my sister some vitamins.
You know, like, what? That's lovely because she can add on to her subscription. My husband likes the Omega supplement that Ritual has. It's like, you know, who doesn't like something they can try for free?
They can try for free. And it also, it works. It's like it's a pleasant vitamin to take.
Yep.
It comes to your door. It's gentle on your stomach with a minty essence in every bottle that helps make taking your multis enjoyable. They did a university-led clinical trial for their Essential Women 18 and Over multivitamin, and they found that it increased vitamin D levels by 43% and omega-3 DHA levels by 41% in just 12 weeks.
So important.
Important, especially during the winter. Ritual's essential third-party tested for heavy metals and clean label projects certified, so you know you can trust what you're putting in your body. It's also HSA and FSA eligible.
Incredible.
End of the year. You got to use those. Use them or lose them, man. So
instead of striving for perfect health, aim for supporting foundational health. Our listeners get early access to their Black Friday sale for 40% off your first month at ritual.com/hysteria. That's ritual.com/hysteria for 40% off your first month. Don't miss out on their best sale of the season.
Hey, everybody, Erin here. Please enjoy this special bonus episode live from CrookedCon. It is my panel, Cutting Through the Slop, featuring Jessica Valenti, Stephanie Valencia, Meredith Lynch, and Tara McGowan. Enjoy. Hey, friends. It sounded like Miss Rachel just then. Sorry. All right. Hi, welcome to CrookedCon. I'm Erin Ryan, and today we are discussing how the right has built an expansive media ecosystem in the past decade. Now, I'm not just talking about Fox News. I'm talking about the pipeline to Fox News, like what people are hearing when they think they're not engaging with the news. So, like, your panic moms, your pugnacious debate dorks, your gym idiots who spend all their time just asking questions, but the questions just so happen to lead them to answers that are Republican talking points. The army of messengers that the right has cultivated is annoying and certainly makes America dumber, but more importantly, this network of right-wing gadflies is huge, it's everywhere, and it's effective. So how can the left catch up, and how can we do it better? So joining me to help get to the bottom of this problem, we have 4 women who have made names for themselves and shown through the molten garbage that is our current media ecosystem. So first, I want to introduce Jessica Valenti. Jessica is a writer, activist, personal hero of mine, and one of the country's most influential voices on gender and politics. The award-winning author of 8 books, including the New York Times bestseller Abortion, has shaped the national conversation. Yes, round of applause. Has shaped the national conversation on feminism for over 2 decades. After the fall of Roe, Jessica founded Abortion Every Day, an urgent synthesis of anything and everything happening with abortion rights in the U.S. A fun fact about Jessica, she's got a 4.5 on WikiFeet. Up next, we have Meredith Lynch. Meredith is a creator, comedian, and social media consultant known for her viral TikTok and Instagram deep dives into pop culture, celebrity brands, and the intersection of entertainment and social justice. She has over 370,000 followers across social media platforms. None of those followers, however, are Lauren Sanchez Bezos, because Lauren Sanchez Bezos has blocked her. Yeah. Up next, we have Stephanie Valencia. Stephanie is the co-founder of Equis, a set of organizations working to create a better understanding of Latinos, innovate new approaches to reach and engage them, and invest in the leadership and infrastructure for long-term change and increased engagement. She's also co-founder and co-owner of the media company Latino Media Network, an audio-focused multimedia company inspiring, informing, and celebrating Latinos, owned and operated by members of the community. A fun fact about Stephanie, she's a big Dodgers fan. That's fun. But when the Dodgers are playing, she has a superstition about eating sunflower seeds. And so during the 18-inning Game 5 of the World Series, she ate 2 bags of sunflower seeds and almost made herself sick. And finally, Tara McGowan. Tara is the founder. Yay, Tara. The founder and publisher of Courier, a pro-democracy news network that builds a more informed, engaged, and representative America by reaching audiences where they are online with factual, values-driven news and analysis. Founded in 2019, Courier is one of the fastest-growing news networks in the country with over 7.5 million online and national brand or national subscribers, including nearly 3 million TikTok followers. Their 11 state newsrooms and national brand collectively reach over 100 million Americans every week. That's a lot. Tara does twice daily transcendental meditation and just started taking martial arts classes, she says, to feel better prepared for America's new violent era.
Not joking.
So Tara, I'm going to start with you, but I'd love to hear answers from everybody about this. So we use the word slop in the title of this panel. For our purposes, we're going to define that as information or content that has an ideological agenda behind it, but does not help its audience develop a clear understanding of the world. Instead, it's made with the intent to both entertain and mislead. So have you ever found yourself entertained by slop, or has a friend shared slop with you? And how did that go?
Well, thank you for having us, Erin, and hi, everybody. I'm very excited to be here. When I heard the title for this, too, I was thinking the association of slop is like AI slop today, but then I was thinking about it more deeply based on your definition, Erin, and it's hard to say what isn't slop anymore. I think the term ideological is an interesting one for this, but really because of the media ecosystem today, it's basically the democratization of information and content, whether you like that or not, right? And influenced by technology and a lot of powerful forces. And so it is becoming increasingly difficult to know what things are real or fake. Truth doesn't really break through. I think this is probably going to be a topic of the conversation today, but how you make the truth engaging and interesting is the creative challenge of democracy now, because I don't think we're putting the genie back in the bottle of how information flows and moves so quickly. So I initially like took issue with the word slop related to this because it was like, well, I think we all produce slop if we're really good right now because we have to break through. Mm-hmm. And that, but to do it in a way that of course is like in line with our values to the degree that that is possible when all the platforms are owned by fascist billionaires these days. I think like I've been misled by some AI that has like really alarmed me because it's just getting better and better, and that's going to happen. That happened actually with the Jimmy Kimmel video. I don't know if anyone else saw that, but one went really viral about him addressing being brought back on. Mm-hmm. That was the one most recently that I saw that I was like, wow, this looks really real. And I thought that it was true. But I do think that's the challenge before all of us is how do we actually, in a flood the zone environment, there's so many zones that have to be flooded, you have to be able to drive a cohesive narrative on offense. And that means you have to pick up on something that a lot of folks can pick up on, but in a specific way that the narrative is defined by how folks are engaging on that issue. And that needs to happen related to breaking news moments. And it has to happen by seeding narratives, which that's what the right has always been really, really effective at. Mm-hmm. They go on offense and then they have all their infrastructure and all of their base supporters online that quickly amplify and drive a narrative they want, whether it's an anti-trans narrative, an anti-immigrant narrative, what have you. They're constantly going back to the well on those to frame those. And I think what we haven't done a good job on our side of until more recently is actually collaboratively driving a narrative on offense that isn't reactive or defensive. And that really is the challenge that I think all of us grapple with every day.
Well, Stephanie, let's talk with you about this. You've done incredible work in the voter research space in addition to working in media, so you have kind of a unique perspective here. From this perspective, is there something from the past decade that you think progressive media has really fumbled?
Oh, really interesting question. I'm going to take the question a little bit more broad to talk about how I think progressives have really fumbled with Latinos generally and how I think there is an opportunity in how we think about media and where Latinos actually are and how they're consuming news and information. Part of the reason we acquired the 18 radio stations we did back in 2022 was we found out Univision was selling these radio stations and they were about to sell them to Salem Media. Everybody here knows who Salem Media is. So we were able to intercept that at the one-yard line and were able to get the backing that was needed to buy these 18 radio stations. And part of the inspiration behind that was in 2006, Spanish language radio DJs played an incredible role in turning out people en masse to protest anti-immigration legislation, the Sensenbrenner Bill of 2006. And so when we thought about what is the role that radio can continue to play with Latinos who are a very, very dynamic group of voters, and I think that's one of the things that progressives, Latinos have never belonged to Democrats and have never really belonged to progressives. And in the last 15 to 20 years, we've actually seen a real attrition and cynicism, a lot of broken promises around delivering immigration reform, and just this overall confidence and trust gap among Latinos with progressives and Democrats. And so partly the desire in acquiring these stations was to inform, educate, and inspire Latinos about the issues that mattered most to them and to help present those issues and educate about those issues so that they could make their own decision, right? And so at the end of the day, well, we were able to do this, and the 2006 immigration marches were a real inspiration for us. What's shifted and changed over time is how Latinos are consuming news and information. YouTube continues to be, and this is research that we've done at ECCIS, kind of the great equalizer among Latinos. Latinos consume YouTube more than other audiences, and it's both among elites and non-elite people. And so when we think about how does radio and these 18 radio stations that we acquired that are speaking to very non-elite, low-information voters. Part of the exciting thing about who we are talking to is they're not hand-raisers. When we go out and build digital platforms, it's really hard to kind of really focus on people who are sitting on the sidelines and not create echo chambers. We were already talking to people who weren't hand-raisers. So now the challenge for all of us, progressive or not, is to really think about how do we connect terrestrial radio to digital and online spaces and vice versa. Because the people who are holding the microphones, the DJs who are on the music stations on Latino Media Network, whether it's in Fresno, McAllen, or Las Vegas, are some of the most trusted voices in people's lives every single day. So how are they communicating and reaching and then taking them into an online journey and going and visiting Courier or going and other finding and directing them to other trusted sources of media? So that is the next big leap that we have to make as progressives and continue to make our case to Latinos about why progressives and a progressive policy agenda is in their self-interest.
This episode is brought to you by Jones Road Beauty.
You know what I hate when it comes to makeup?
Most of it.
Most of it. I hate a cakey makeup. I hate makeup that takes up too much space and doesn't do enough. I don't like makeup that just at the end of the day, when I like look in the mirror, I can just like see it sitting on top of my skin.
Yes. And you know what? I do. My skin has gotten dry as I've gotten older. I can't have something where I'm just looking chalky by the end of the day.
Exactly. That's why I really love Jones Road Beauty.
Love it.
It is a minimalist makeup brand founded by makeup artist Bobby Brown that creates versatile and easy-to-use products that simplify your routine. Every formula is packed with clean, skin-loving ingredients, and my skin loves it back.
Love it back. Jones Road just launched their most giftable and exclusive holiday collection yet. All five limited edition kits in the collection are trios that include new holiday shades, products, and packaging. Whether you're gifting or getting ready for holiday parties, these curated sets take the guesswork out of your makeup routine. Don't miss out. The sets won't be here for long, and once they're gone, they're gone.
All Jones Road Beauty products are actually good for your skin. They look and feel natural, like you're not wearing makeup at all. I can definitely attest to that. It's if you want to look like you're not wearing makeup, but you're actually wearing makeup.
I have it on today.
I have it on today too. Create that effortless, natural, no makeup makeup look. Their bestseller is Miracle Balm. I love that stuff.
Love
the ultimate makeup skincare hybrid product that gives natural glow. It's a great multitasker, blush, tint, bronzer, highlight on lips. I used it on my eyelids the other day.
Yeah, me too. I use it everywhere.
Success. This holiday season, simplify your routine with makeup that's clean, strategic, and multifunctional. From November 18th to December 1st, Jones Road is doing their first ever Black Friday sale. Go to jonesroadbeauty.com to get up to 20% off site-wide. That's jonesroadbeauty.com for up to 20% off your entire order. After your purchase, they'll ask where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you.
This year, experience the NHL playoffs your way. Want to watch a single? Do or Die Game 7, a full week of heavy-hitting back-and-forth series. Then check out Sling's 1-3 and 7-day passes. Watch The Chase for the Cup on ESPN and TNT, starting as low as $4.99. No long-term contracts or overpaying. Just live hockey at home or when you want it. Sling lets you do that. Visit sling.com to learn more.
So, Jessica, what is your North Star in deciding when to cover something or when to just sit one out? Like, you cover, you have a, your Substack, Abortion Every Day, is it's in the title, guys. It's abortion. So, but, like, in general, when you're on social media, when you're just Jessica Valenti, someone that people look to, when do you decide to sit something out?
I don't think I've ever done that. that's not really... That's not really for me. Obviously, right now, because of the Substack, I'm sort of, you know, solely focusing on abortion rights. But I have to say something about the slop. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to get back to it. I think that we need to broaden what we're thinking of as slop in a major way. Like, as soon as you asked that question, I thought about tradwife content. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, it's not AI. It's not what we would normally think of as right-wing slop. But that's exactly what it is, and they're doing such a good job with it. And I think one of the issues is that we're never gonna really effectively fight back against that. We're not gonna stop that. We're not gonna stop tradwife content. We're not gonna stop AI slop. But one of the things that I'm trying to do with Abortion Every Day is sort of focus on the things that I can control or the things that I have influence on. And I think one of the things that we do have influence on is mainstream media, right? Right-wing slop is one thing, right-wing messaging is one thing, but for me, the real problem comes up when mainstream outlets are just repeating the messaging from that slop. Mm-hmm. It happens so often, especially with abortion, right? The both sides media stuff, sort of accepting all of these bullshit talking points unchallenged. So that, I think, is one of the biggest things I'm concerned about. To get back to your actual question, I think if it doesn't have to do with abortion these days, I'm just not thinking about it. You know, One of the reasons I think that people come to the Substack or follow my content is because they know that I'm so singularly obsessed. And I think right now there's so much going on specifically around reproductive rights that the only way you really are going to make inroads, the only way you are going to catch sort of the sneaky tactics of what they're up to is to be that obsessed, is to block everything else out and just go all in on, you know, one narrow topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of like speed running through fact checking that happens on the right, especially like in the slop sphere, if you will, where people will just say a bunch of things in a row that are like factually incorrect and they don't get checked. And Meredith, I wanted to talk to you about what you cover, because what you cover, like in a lot of cases, is something that the mainstream media doesn't stop and think to fact check. So can you talk a little bit about how you pick subjects to take a deep dive into and how you think that helps people understand stories more clearly?
Yeah, definitely. First of all, can we just give it up for like a badass panel of all women? Like, look at this, right? My God. You know, here's the thing. The Kardashians and climate change are connected. And I'm never going to be invited to Kris Jenner's holiday party, even though I would still go. But so I'm not afraid to say that. And I think it's like, this is an opportunity. Like, we are being fed celebrity all the time, but it is political. And there is a way to talk about that and to bring people into the conversation. And like, I'm not afraid to start a video with like, Lauren Sanchez blocked me, or the Kardashians are broke, or anything like that, that will hook people in and then get to the main point. And to your, what you were talking about before, I just want to say something that I tell people all the time is like, if you feel overwhelmed in this moment, which like who doesn't, pick one issue, Exactly. Pick one issue and like lean into it, because I got into private equity and that's how I realized like I could connect it to so many different things.
You got
things.
Into like, shit talking.
Shit talk. Oh yeah, yeah. They are not a fan.
Doing private equity.
I'm private equity's public enemy, which is the name I gave myself. But yeah, and so it's like when you can pick one issue, like you have, it goes, and then you realize that it's so interconnected, and it really will make you feel, I think, a lot more empowered, and it really helps tune out some of that noise. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think, go ahead.
I just wanted to add something to that. I think also just being useful to people, right? Like, I think one of the reasons Abortion Every Day has done well is because we're filling an actual gap and we're serving an actual audience need, which is there is no like terrific mainstream, ongoing, consistent mainstream coverage of abortion rights. There is no, not no, but there's not a ton of coverage that says it like it is, that's candid, and there's not a lot that is sort of giving you just like the rundown of every single thing that's happening, because it is so overwhelming, because the attacks are ongoing. The ability to like sit and read an email for 2 minutes and feel like you're caught up makes people feel like they are getting a service, right? Like you are being useful to them. And I think that that is just, I don't know, it's one of the most important things we can do, I think, especially right now with everything so chaotic.
Yeah, for sure. Tara, you were nodding as though you had some thoughts there. Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I was thinking about it. I mean, I've been following Jessica's work since I was in college early, truly. And I think that what's really interesting in the moment that we're in right now, social media is mainstream media, right? There is no other mainstream media. Nothing else is actually reaching the masses. It is what your feed is, or the multiple feeds that you look at every single day, whether that's your inbox, your messaging threads, your TikTok feed, your Instagram feed, et cetera. And so actually what's happening is that trusted voices have always been the core of media. It just used to be a select few old white men on evening news and the mastheads of the legacy newspapers, et cetera. And now it's no different. It's who you trust. It's just that there's so many more voices, and having an expertise and a focus is so critical right now, because before we relied on a few news organizations to hire those experts as beat reporters or columnists, et cetera. And now you have this plethora of, you can find anyone who has any opinion or expertise, et cetera, and you're trusting
trusting them because you are seeing them go to that well every single day. And now we have the ability to also add that emotional component, which is what drives trust and engagement. And so I just think that I wish there were more Jessicas right now, because honestly, that is the replacement of the old traditional media, is folks that are obsessively focused. Like, I'm so jealous also listening to that, because like, we're builders of platforms that are trying to incorporate all of that. But when I think about the future of Courier, and we're already doing it in a lot of ways, though, it's positioning ourselves to be the aggregator of the best and smartest voices and content, and not just having them be Courier reporters, of which we have amazing ones, but it's how do we actually uplift and amplify all of the amazing, incredible reporters and experts and creators that are out there, because it is a slop fest on all of these feeds. And the more that we can do that, we can accrue more growth and influence and give more of that to the people who should be heard. Mm-hmm. So that was where my train of thought was going.
And I just want to tell two quick stories, which is one of a DJ in Las Vegas, Nevada. His name is DJ Gabo. He is the morning DJ drive time. He, when I first met him, the first time I went to Las Vegas and to the radio station, he was telling me a story about a young immigrant who called him and said, for the longest time when I first came here, I didn't really know anybody. I was navigating the world on my own, and you were the one trusted voice that I would hear every morning and that was consistent in my life. So that guy has so much currency of trust with his listeners. And so now that we're in this really sad and very intense moment that the Latino community and immigrants are under attack in this country, DJ Gabo and where he directs people for resources and the local community group, the local immigration resources that he can point people to about Know Your Rights is really, really important. The second thing is, in our work at ECCYS, we're doing a really cool thing this year where we're following six different voters from the 2024 election throughout. And I was lucky enough to sit in one of these ethnographies with a woman in New Jersey. And, you know, we're talking to them about how are they digesting this moment, the world, who are they voting for, why, what media are they consuming? And she talked about this guy, Ben Zamora. I had never heard of this guy, but this guy was literally a former reporter from like Univision and Telemundo in Las Vegas that had been laid off in the last couple of years. And just when he was laid off, went to TikTok and started reporting the news about what was happening. The guy has 6 million followers on TikTok. Wow. More than Univision and Telemundo probably combined get on their their national newscast. So people, it is very, very fractured. You know, and obviously not all people are former journalists like him and are probably approaching the work with that level of rigor. But I think it really goes to show the kind of fractured media ecosystem that exists today, and really these different influencers that have built and kind of taken their own followings and translated that into continuing to build an audience.
Yeah, it sounds like we all agree about the future of trust and individual expertise. Not to come back to shitting on mainstream media outlets, but I will.
Deserved.
I want to make sure we don't forget about that. We can build that trust. We can have those individual relationships with our audiences. But I get nervous that as we're building that, we're going to forget to hold mainstream outlets to account, because like it or not, people are going to the Times, they're going to the Post for the final word on something, right? Like someone may trust me, but they'll still say, well, the Times says this, and it makes a huge impact. Before Trump and Vance were elected, they had this whole thing about, we don't support a national abortion ban, we support a minimum national standard, which is a fucking abortion ban. It's the same thing. But like, all of these news outlets were repeating that, oh, they don't support a national abortion ban, they would veto a national abortion ban, they just want a minimum national standard, right? Mm-hmm. So things like that make a huge difference. And I promise I'll shut up in a second. But that's part of the reason why, like, one of the things that we're doing with the newsletter, in addition to sort of like providing the service for people, is my hope always when I'm writing an email is that a reporter, because we have a ton of media folks who read, is that a reporter, a cable news producer, is going to see a story or going to see the way that we frame that story and take it and run with it. And it happens all the time now, I'm very, very happy to say. Like, we'll be able to publish something and then 2 hours later the AP will come out with the exact same story, which is the point. Mm-hmm. I think if we could focus, we have to do both jobs, right? Like building those individual audiences and also not forgetting that we need to hold those outlets accountable.
Can I ask a quick follow-up question on that? Because this is something that I'm thinking about a lot. How do you square that with the increasing capitulation of the corporate media when they're going to stop covering it at all? And or just continue to drive that narrative. And so the thing I worry about with that, because I absolutely agree with the merits of what you're saying, is like you could spend every single day of your life, which I know, Jesse, you already do a lot of, trying to correct the record and getting it into the right places where they can. When those places are gone because they're not, like, what does that, right? Then that becomes less of a lever, right? It's still important today in like a good way, but I actually very much worry that what we're already seeing and the thing I lose the most sleep about is what's no longer being covered.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not just how things are being covered and how that's changing, because even the New York Times does not want to piss off this administration, right? Mm-hmm. The No Kings protest, the largest U.S. protest in my lifetime as a 39-year-old, was below the fold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On the front page of the New York Times. So, and they're one of the few that hasn't fully capitulated and literally sent millions of dollars to build the ballroom. So in with that being one of the sort of strategic pillars of the work that you do that is so important, where does that go when they aren't, they're never going to be held accountable unless because they're just appeasing the regime?
I think that you just need to shame them and make it embarrassing not to cover a topic, right? Like, they need to feel very embarrassed. I feel like it is super embarrassing that big mainstream publications are not covering the fact that, you know, a dozen states introduced bills that would charge abortion patients with homicide. That's nuts that we haven't heard about that, mm-hmm. right? Like, it is crazy that we haven't heard about all of these different pieces of legislation, and I agree with you, and we're already seeing it happen, right?
I was gonna say, it's intentional. It's not nuts. It's intentional.
Right. It's intentional. I think that, like, making them feel embarrassed, and this is where building our own audiences comes in useful. I'll give an example. When we cover a story of a woman who was arrested for her miscarriage, which unfortunately happens quite a lot, and you won't see that coverage anywhere, but if I get enough views on a video, it becomes embarrassing and we'll see the switch happen where it's mm-hmm. like, okay, I guess we're gonna have to cover this because everyone's talking about it. So we have to make sure that people are talking about the important stuff.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about the attention economy and the trust economy, which are two really important components of media. But we need to talk about the money economy. In order for these media apparatuses, the right-wing media apparatuses, to work, they need money. And they're getting a lot of money. There are, you know, there's entire billionaire schemes on the right designed to influence media and culture. And since 2020, you know, we've seen Vice went bankrupt. Remember when Vice was just King shit of fuck mountain. BuzzFeed essentially, you know, shut down a newsroom that was doing incredible work. And my former employer, Gawker Media, RIP, was basically sued into oblivion by a Peter Thiel-backed plot. It was like fully a plot. If you don't know about it, you should read.
Over Hulk Hogan.
Yeah. With Hulk Hogan. Crazy. Was the end of the golden age of digital media inevitable, Tara? And, like, how do we replace, how do we compete with the money that is being thrown at right-wing creators right now?
Apparently, you install a president who forces you to pay to play to be able to get tax cuts. Because not only was there already dominant right-wing media infrastructure for decades and decades that was always able to stay on or ahead of the curve in terms of the media changing and technology changing, right? They started with talk radio. They went to cable news with Fox News. Breitbart was an early mover online, right? They got Turning Point USA is literally the talent pipeline builder of the right, Candace Owens. I mean, so many of them. I don't want to name them all. But what's happening now is that we're actually getting more right-wing media because of this president. So I've been saying something a lot lately, like, where is my Larry Ellison? But Larry Ellison would be my Larry Ellison if we had a Democratic president, potentially, mm-hmm. that he needed to appease, and that was the way that he appeased them, because I don't think Larry Ellison is actually necessarily a MAGA person, but he understands right now, and he is transforming CBS News by installing Barry Weiss in that position, where that is a right-wing media now. Washington Post eliminating any opinions that aren't about the free market, however you want to define that, Jeff Bezos, right? Mm-hmm. It is So what's really, really troubling right now is that it isn't actually just the ideological billionaires that are driving enormous investments in media on the right. Now it's also just the pure capitalists who are just incentivized by greed and ego and clearly insecurity, feeding all of those things, that are now actually scaling this to the point where it's like we were already starting behind. We do not have brave billionaires. Mm-hmm. And part of that is not their fault. There is actually a financial...
If they're not brave, why can't we just go take all their money? Like, they're not going to fight. Only half joking.
I mean, I want to talk about that offline.
Okay, yeah.
I'm like very intrigued because I think I'm trying to do that. But I know that there is a financial incentive structure on the right for investing in media that changes political outcomes that has been shown to be dramatically effective over decades and decades. So they know that media is the whole thing. If you don't win the information war, you do not win the political war. Mm-hmm. And so we do not have the investors or investment on our side to be as ruthless, as risk inclined, as innovative, as trusting of media founders like myself and Stephanie and others, because there is no financial incentive. They're going to ask us the questions of like, well, how are you going to make money? Because the right wing media makes money. And it's like, well, they had enormous incentive investment on the front end mm-hmm. to build to the point of being profitable. If somebody gave me $100 million, I would make that shit profitable in a few years. I'm like, you want to give me $5 million? No, you're not getting the $5 million back ever. And I'm going to ask you for another $5 million or $10 million next year. And I'm not going to grow at the pace that I could. Mm-hmm. So they don't have a financial incentive. So it's really just an altruistic incentive. And I think that should be enough because I don't think that billionaires should exist. And we do have some good ones that believe that, but they aren't choosing media as the thing. Mm-hmm. And I always say this too, like on our side, because we do have a big tent, like our the biggest media platforms on our side that are not nearly big enough, we are reliant on getting money from 1,000 people or 1,000,000 people through grassroots donations as a part of that, where on the other side, it's 4 billionaires. Mm-hmm. You just need one mm-hmm. to believe in you and go all in. Mm-hmm. And that's, I have been trying to solve that problem for 10 years. We have not solved that problem. In fact, there are less billionaires investing in this work today than there was a year ago for very, very, very obvious reasons.
Stephanie, you're nodding vehemently.
Yeah, I just want to say I still think digital is the future and where we should be building our own kind of networks and ecosystem, even though we don't have the kind of similar backing as the right does. One of the downsides of we have incredible scale at LMN, and like I said, we're talking to the non-hand raisers, the people who are non-elite, low-information voters that are really important people to be talking to outside of election cycles. That being said, we're government regulated by the FCC. And so there is a layer of scrutiny that we are under. And not to mention, to Tara's point, this need to produce revenue to survive. So the economy is shitty right now. It is especially shitty with Latinos and in Latino communities that we're operating in. Places like Las Vegas are seeing the worst economic conditions that they have in a long time. So 85% of our advertisers on our radio stations are local media or local and small business owners. So the local carniceria, the car wash, the car dealership, those are our customers. So when people are not coming over from Mexico to McAllen on the weekend to go shopping, those small business owners don't have money to invest in radio ads. And so it becomes this crazy cycle that we, you know, are having to really face and kind of build from to in order to survive this moment in time. And ultimately, again, we have to make this bridge from terrestrial radio to the online and digital space as well, because there is more opportunity to monetize in a more creative way in digital spaces. Last thing I would just say, the behemoth of Univision, which for many, many years has gone over lots of different ownership, and when Univision was originally started, was truly started with the intention of informing and inspiring the community, but it's gone through many layers of private equity and profit-driven motives, and right now is owned by a set of people who are in Mexico, who are very aligned with the Trump administration. And it is one of the, I think, deepest and most existential threats that nobody is talking about, because they very much aligned themselves with Trump during the election. And who knows, as we will continue to see through the evolution of all of the rule changes we're seeing at the FCC, we're about to see probably the largest amount of consolidation of media and local markets, and really a domination of just a handful of media companies in local markets. And so that is really what we're up against. And with Univision in the pocket, basically, of the Trump administration, I think we've only begun to see the beginning of what could be possible to try to sway this community from another perspective. Mm-hmm.
This episode is brought to you by Pregnancy Justice. We seek justice above all else. And you know what's not a crime? Having a miscarriage. But in states across America, anti-abortion leaders are trying to make being pregnant, having a miscarriage, or seeking abortion a crime. Across the country, they're giving legal rights to fertilized eggs, embryos, and fetuses, which means pregnant people have fewer rights. It gives the police and prosecutors permission to target and jail women for all kinds of behaviors they don't like during pregnancy. What this leads to is more women facing jail time for having miscarriages or abortion. It restricts access to fertility treatments like IVF and means that pregnant people will be more afraid and unable to get the medical care that they need. These efforts to make pregnancy a crime are not just about safety or care, but about control. They're about forcing women back to a time when we could not make basic decisions about our bodies, whether it was to get birth control, get an abortion, or decide when and how we start a family. In the years since the fall of Roe, we have seen these cases continue to go up. A recent report from Pregnancy Justice, a national organization that defends the rights of pregnant women, tracked over 412 cases across the country charging women with crimes related to their pregnancy, pregnancy loss, or birth in just the 2 years since Roe has fallen.
Our justice system should be focused on solving real crimes, not attacking pregnant people for their personal health care decisions. Pregnancy Justice is fighting for a future where pregnant women are in charge of their own bodies and lives, free from government control and the fear of jail time. We deserve care and compassion, not punishment. Learn more at pregnancyjusticeus.org/notacrime. That's pregnancyjusticeus.org/notacrime.
East of the Pacific, making histories of Asian American art. On view now through August 16th at the Columbus Museum of Art. Featuring more than 60 works of artists of Asian descent, the exhibition explores how migration across the Pacific has shaped American art and culture. Experience the stories, perspectives, and artistic contributions that continue to influence our world. Don't miss East of the Pacific, making histories of Asian American art, now through August 16th. Plan your visit today at columbusmuseum.org.
Meredith, I wanted to pivot to you a little bit, because I think another challenge with being somebody with progressive politics who wants people to pay attention to the truth and pay attention to progressive stories and get that information out there right now is that a lot of people are fucking sick of the news. They are so sick of the news. It is everywhere. Thanks to Donald Trump, it is everything. It is sports. It is pop culture. How are you able to spread a message or have a political agenda using stories that aren't news stories? Can you walk us through how you do that?
Well, let me make my case for the Starbucks Bear Cup. Thank you. Thank you for laughing. Okay, so there is this Starbucks Bear Cup, and everybody is like, did people see this? It came out yesterday. People are like fighting each other in the store for it. Okay, I have a hot take. Can we swear up here?
Yeah.
Oh,
I just said fucking.
Oh, okay, all right. Oh, all right. I kind of fuck with the Starbucks Bear Cup. Okay, I gotta tell you, first of all, it's very cute. I don't know have you seen it?
I've seen it.
It's very cute.
I've watched the lines.
But here's the thing, right? Like, this is the entry point. It is so shitty out there right now that, like, no wonder we're all hyped up over a Starbucks Bear Cup. Like, I can't control anything. I'm on the ACA. I got a letter the other day that said, your premiums are gonna go up. How much? We don't know. Okay? Like, I can't control anything, but I can get in line and get the Starbucks Bear Cup. So it's like, those are the entry points that we can have to go, you guys, the reason that everyone's taking this so seriously right now, or the reason that Candace Owens was so smart to tap into Justin Baldoni and Blake Lively, that was a tactic. They pick these things, and then you can delve deeper into the political piece. So yes, it's a little bit of a bait and switch, but like, listen, you gotta.
It's also being a part of a community with someone,
right?
Like even the Starbucks beer cup is a community. Yes. If you're sick of news, I'm sick of news too. My readers are sick of the news, but we can be sick of it together, mm-hmm. right? Like there is this feeling of like shared frustration or shared small bits of joy that we can also speak to.
And I think that's the other thing. One of the things that I deal with as a creator, I'm sure y'all encounter this as well, and there's so many creators here today, is like, people will be like, I liked you more when you did beauty content. I liked you more when you fought with Bethany Frankel, which that's not over. I don't like it when you talk about this issue. I do like it when you talk about that issue. And it's like, I think sometimes also too, like you can't get all your news from Meredith M. Lynch. You can't get everything. Like you know what I mean? And so I think it's like, you can't get all your news from one place. You have to switch it up. I have to talk about the silly things. I have to talk about the more serious things. And that balance is what I think invites people in, right? Like let's hook them in with like something kind of fun and then show them how like, yeah, unfortunately everything's political. But also too, you have the opportunity to put the phone down, to put the TV off. I think that's the other thing. Like we're all self-included. So programmed now to be attached to our screens. It's like, I'm also working on like, how do I have better consumption of my media? And that's, I think, another thing that really can help people when they're like, I'm so sick of the news. And it's like, okay, cool. You don't have to pick up your phone every 5 minutes, mm-hmm. like self-included. So yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about politicians and the way that they engage with progressive media. What is the responsibility, Tara, light question, of politicians on the left to engage with diverse and upcoming media?
I mean, do they want to stay politicians? Mm. It's a prerequisite. And it's good because it is also a bit of a litmus test for them. And as if they can hang in the media environment today, which is the political environment today, which is the social environment today that we live in, because if they are visibly uncomfortable or reliant on talking points or poll-tested messages, even in these very, very relaxed personal podcast recordings or interviews with different creators and outlets, they can't hide that, and it doesn't serve their goals or the goals of the audience, et cetera. And so there's like a weeding out that's happening that I think is really overdue. Of like anyone who doesn't actually have a personality or anything really like underneath why they're doing what they're doing that is like passionate, emotional, personal. I don't think that they should be in those positions anymore. And I think in this moment in particular, if you are in the House or the Senate, if you're in the federal government, you actually don't have power. Your power is messaging and communications. It is not legislating. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of people in Congress that are very good at writing at policymaking, right? And negotiating for different policies when we had a normal government where that was something that happened, which I don't even remember when that really, really was. But right now, what really matters is breaking through, showing that you can fight, showing that you're at the right side of things, showing that you're not corrupt, by the way, which is why the Democratic brand is so soiled, is because people don't trust them. I think we had an amazing day on Tuesday across the board, despite Democrats. Mm-hmm. And and truly, and we had that in 2018 and 2020, and a lot of lessons weren't learned. And so I actually think where the media ecosystem is today and who holds the real power of influence today when it comes to podcasts and online outlets and creators and things of that nature, it is forcing this reckoning of like, are you a real person, mm-hmm. who has real values and real character, and are in this for the right reasons? And it's very, very visible when you're not, and they hate that. Yeah. They hate that, but I think that that's actually a really important purge that we're going through right now.
Whenever I have to talk to whenever I have to talk to politicians and give them advice about, well, how should we be talking to Latinos or how should we be doing? And what I remind people is like, go do the interview with Ben Zamora, because Benzamore is going to reach more people than almost anybody else that you're going to do it with. Secondly, be authentic. Don't try. At one point last year during the election, Joe Biden, and God bless his heart, like did an interview on a Spanish, on one of the most popular Spanish language morning show broadcasts called Chicky, the Chicky Baby Show. It was painful. It was not authentic, right? And so, you know, people like AOC should be doing Twitch because she actually plays video games. Chuck Schumer should never do Twitch, right? Like, so really, and then I just say that, you know, this members of Congress, candidates, campaigns need to think about social media differently. And the one example I will use is Jimmy Gomez. He's a congressman from Los Angeles, actually represents Dodger Stadium, so always bring it back to the Dodgers. And one of the things he's done is he's rethought his entire communication shop. He no longer has a press secretary anymore. If you are familiar with the LA market, you can't break into local media in the LA market. He has completely flipped his communications team. He has now a content creation team. And he is probably, I would almost classify him in some ways as a citizen journalist because he is covering all of the immigration-related work and raids and everything that is happening in detention centers in Los Angeles. He is going and taking his camera when he's going to these detention centers. And so he's now becoming this content creator that is fundamentally different than most congressional offices think about communicating with their constituents now.
I think that's 100% true, but also the thing I worry about is that the online reality and the new media reality for female politicians is very, very different mm-hmm. than for men. And so asking women in office to get online and be authentic and be themselves looks so different for them. And what I'm concerned about is because that is so necessary, right? And those new media relationships are so necessary that we are going to see just an overwhelming number of male candidates, more than we already have, and male politicians becoming more likable, becoming, who's the, there's an Andrew podcast guy.
Who has the mustache?
Friedlander, right?
Schultz. Pete Buttigieg went on, and yes, Andrew Schultz. And Pete Buttigieg went on, and I had this conversation with my husband where he's like, see, like, if, you know, if we just had some people go on, look at how everything Pete Buttigieg said. He was like, oh, yeah, okay, because, you know, they're sort of dumb, and they, no, I mean, really, and they, and they're like, oh, when you put it like that, that's great. Sure, but do you think that if a woman was up there, they would be listening in the same way? Not even a little bit, right? And so I think, unfortunately, it is all true, but we have to figure out a way to make it so that we don't sort of replicate the same systems and the same models that have yeah. that have kept women out.
Yeah, I mean, I remember during the, that's absolutely right. During the 2024 campaign, one of the things that I saw people say about Kamala Harris was that she was fake. And to me, that just registered as like, oh, she just is like controlling herself and controlling the way that she speaks. Like, I don't know how to like, in, like, how would a candidate engage authentically enough for an audience in a environment, like Jessica said, that treats men showing off for each other as authenticity and women just trying to be in control as fake. So how do we navigate that?
I was actually thinking about this as you answered that question, Jess, because it is a real challenge, especially for women of older generations who didn't grow up online, right? I think there is a generational divide because the bar is different for women and men of all ages, no question about it. We know that the largest and fastest growing, even on the left, new platforms and shows on YouTube and in podcasts are white men. It's just true. And so that's not an accident because they are able to be more comfortable. And I think that's part of it is also like, I don't know if we're going to solve it for the older generations of women because a lot of it is so entrenched that they had to present in a certain way and in a different way for different audiences that it makes you inauthentic because that discomfort is visible. And it's also like deeply like, I'm so compassionate towards it because I understand why. We had the same thing with Hillary Clinton. Like, you talk to Hillary Clinton and she's hysterical in a riot, and you never saw that version of her when she was building a political career. Kamala Harris obviously, like, has a lot of trust issues because she gets different advice from all sorts of people about how to show up as a Black woman in America running for president. And so it gets to this point of how people, humans respond to authenticity, and they can smell when you're not being authentic. And it doesn't mean that you're being malicious. It means that you've been told that you need to be a million different things, and women are the ones who are most subject to that. And so I do think that part of it is actually like having more media run by women, having more women hosts that are running the media and the conversations and things of that nature, because we need to not have it be a patriarchal media ecosystem like every other system we've had in this country. We actually need to have more women as the business leaders, the ones who are developing shows, the ones that are driving the conversations, because that's going to create, if nothing else, a much more safe space to be yourself as a woman and connect with women audiences, which is more than half the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also more accurate reporting. Like, yeah. Sorry, but like that will lead to more accurate reporting when it comes to reproductive rights, when it comes to abortion rights. Like, I cannot tell you the number of times I've written an op-ed for a big publication and have gotten in fights with male editors or male fact checkers because they didn't believe what I was saying was true, like some very basic abortion fact. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, also, it makes me think of that recent meeting in the Oval where RFK Jr. said that he saw a TikTok of a woman with a baby in her placenta. Why was it there? What was it doing? It shouldn't be there. It shouldn't be there. But I feel like more women in a reporting space, somebody would have been like, excuse me, what are you trying to give women advice on what to do with their bodies, and you can't describe what a placenta does? Maybe those two things shouldn't be in the same person.
This episode is brought to you by Lola Blankets. Ooh, Alyssa, what's your personal wind-down ritual?
My wind-down ritual, some tea, little honey, get on the sofa, put on a bad TV show under a cozy little blanket.
You gotta have a blanket.
You gotta have a blanket. Otherwise,
like,
it's not the same.
I'm not fully relaxed if I'm not under a blanket that is up to my standards.
Like, and up to my neck.
Up to my neck, up to my standards. I'm definitely a blanket person, which is why I love Lola. Lola is the world's number one blanket, created with ultra-soft luxury vegan faux fur and a signature four-way stretch that sets it apart. I cannot believe these blankets.
I know. Like, they're amazing.
They're amazing. I've had faux fur, like, blankets before, and they've always had shortcomings because they didn't stretch or the fur would come out.
They shed.
Yeah, exactly. And Lola's not like that. It's machine washable, double hem for durability, and it stays flawless. No pilling, no shedding, even after repeated washings. It's the kind of quality you can feel the moment you touch it. And during the holidays, it's the kind of gift that feels extra special because you know it will last for years to come.
Erin, Lola is my go-to gift. It's personal, it's beautiful, and something people will actually use every day. And this time of year, when you're decorating and pulling your home together, a Lola isn't just a blanket. It's the missing piece that makes your space feel complete, warm, and inviting. I discovered Lola through Instagram, and it's become one of those things I recommend the most during the holidays because once someone feels it, they're hooked. Lola has over 10,000 five-star reviews, and once you feel it, you'll know why. There's a reason it's called the world's number one blanket. This thing is next level.
It comes in a range of sizes. I have the large. It's great for cozying up solo or with someone else. XL is massive. They call it the biggest blanket on the internet. I don't know how you'd fact check that one, but I'm going to take their word for it. They also make weighted blankets. I love a weighted blanket.
I love a weighted blanket.
You know, on election night 2024, when I was really, really stressed out,
yeah,
I went into the lactation room here at Crooked Media and went underneath a weighted blanket.
Oh, you needed that.
It calmed me enough to be able to do a podcast that night.
Yeah.
Don't miss the matching pillows. They look amazing, and you save when bundling. Give the gift of softness this holiday season with Lola Blankets. For a limited time, our listeners are getting a huge 40% off their entire order at lolablankets.com by using code Hysteria at checkout. Just head to lolablankets.com and use code Hysteria for 40% off. After you purchase, they'll ask where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Let's talk a little bit more about
women, and specifically women of color and young women. So on Tuesday, Democrats like won the table, right? And it was a good night for Democrats. When you take a look at like exit polling, which isn't completely 100% reliable, but it's the best we have right now, young women are and women of color are the ones that fueled those victories. When you take a look at, yes,
always,
way to go. When you take a look at who has microphones and who has cameras on them and who are the opinion havers and the trusted voices, I mean, present company excluded, it is still disproportionately white men. Like, how do we reckon with that as progressive media figures?
I just have to say something about young female voters and young women of color who are voting. Democrats need to stop taking them for granted. Yes. And assume that they're always going to be there. It is not true, especially with the trad wife slop. Mm-hmm. Right? And the way conservatives right now are spending so much money reaching out to young women specifically, mm-hmm. like it's insane. And what are Democrats doing? They're trying to get back young
men.
Right. Like they're focused on young men.
Because Joe Rogan of the left.
Right. So that because they think that we're always going to be here. Mm-hmm. And from what I see, it's just not true. And I think that if we don't turn it around in the next couple of years, you're going to see a generation of young women who've grown up without reproductive rights and who have been successfully convinced that that's a good thing mm-hmm. because birth control hurts you anyway. Mm-hmm. And if we're not pushing back against that in the media, they're not getting sex education. They're not getting that information anywhere else. And so that is my big mm-hmm. concern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll just add there's been this obsession with Latino men and why did Latino men shift? And I think one of the things we say at Equis is, we are not a monolith, but we still moved as a group and we moved everywhere. And I'm going to finish with where I started, which is Latinos are incredibly dynamic. And that's all subgroups of the community. That's men, that's women, that's different levels of education, that's Cuban, that's Colombian, that's in New Jersey, that's in Miami, that's in South Texas. And that's what we saw happen in 2024. And what we saw happen on Tuesday was, again, the dynamism that exists in the electorate. And my guess is because Latinas, as the heads of their households, you know, they're figuring out what they're going to put on the table for dinner at night, they are experiencing inflation and the affordability crisis in a very real and different way. And on top of it, oh, by the way, ICE could pick me up or could come to our daycare or is in my community, and now I have to worry about that too. And so from our perspective, I think there are a couple of things that are really, really important in this moment. I just want to make sure to get this in. It's not totally directly related to the question, but I think the importance of messengers is really, and what we're saying in this moment, which is one, elevating the stories of immigration and the indiscriminateness of immigration enforcement across this country right now, being able to share those stories and keeping those stories at the top of people's algorithms is really, really important because when that is happening, like we cannot get frozen and paralyzed into, oh, well, you know, I'm so tired, this is like just how it is, or this is, I'm just so tired and I need to shut it off. We have to keep sharing those stories because as they filter down into people's algorithms, it is changing public opinion. There are studies that show as these stories are in the news, they are shifting public opinion. And so it is our duty to make sure that we are keeping those top of mind. It is horrific. And for anybody who has not moved to their core to watch somebody be deported out of a daycare center, or the one that I saw this morning of the guy having a seizure holding onto his toddler. Like if we are not moved by that, all of us should be sharing those stories every single day. The second is being able to create a container and shifting a permission structure for people who voted for Trump. We cannot shame people anymore, especially in the Latino community. We have been working very hard to approach it with curiosity and understand why people felt like they had to vote for him and why they voted for him. And now many people regret their vote. Many of the voters who voted for him and who are irregular voters and are coming in and out of the election and voted for Trump for the first time in 2024, more than, I think it's like 45, 50% regret their choice or are disappointed in their choice. So there's an opportunity there. But we have to be elevating those Trump dissenters and those voters who are saying, I didn't sign up for this. Mm-hmm. So we have to lift up those stories. We can't shame them. I have to say, come to the tent. Come, the water is warm over here. Mm-hmm. Because that is the only way we are going to be able to shift the social acceptability of voting for Trump in, again, or Republicans in the future.
Mm-hmm. So, Stephanie, I'm really glad you mentioned the big tent. And I'm really glad that you brought up those stories, because I think in the new media age, like, emotion actually is an important component of storytelling and of engagement. And authentic expressions of emotion related to things that are happening in the news are not something that we should be shying away from, in my opinion. Because authentic expressions of emotion drive, first of all, they drive engagement and they drive us as human beings. Like, we shouldn't just be like trying to objectively take in facts without like processing the human like echoes of those facts. So let's talk about the big tent. On the right, you see a lot of like slap fighting, and it is very funny. But on the left, you know, you tend to see people be more in lockstep and seem a little bit more anxious about stepping out of line of like the mainstream. What is something that, in your opinion, is not welcome in the big tent? And what is something that you think should be more welcome in the big tent? Tara, I'm going to start with you.
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, something that doesn't feel welcome on, I mean, I think part of it, I'm thinking about the big tent, and because it is such a big tent, there is always a tendency and a pull to have safer arguments when the threat that we all share is so big and so daunting, and those safer arguments are within the tent. Mm-hmm. And that hurts us enormously. And it's, but I understand human behavior and why that occurs is that it is easier to fight with somebody that you have some common ground with and try to move them and feel like you can move them. And I'm sort of, in thinking about the content side of that, right, it's easier to call out and shame your colleagues in the big tent on the broader left for saying something that you think is, you know, not politically correct or something of that nature, because you feel like you can win or take some control.
They're actually going to care.
Where it feels incredibly helpless to be screaming into the void at the literal fascism that we are now experiencing and going to be experiencing in a much, much, much more dark way over the coming years. And I think that that is some of the most hopeful moments I've ever had in working in politics and media have been when people who really don't get along about a lot of different things in this broader space came together in unity against Trump the first time. And it was after, because nobody took him as a serious threat in 16. So it was in the lead up to the 2020 election where folks put all those differences aside and were really just focused on the common threat. And I think that the American people are there, the majority, as we saw on Tuesday night. But I have not actually seen that occur this time around as much yet in a way that is necessary for us to be able to actually take power back in some way, shape, or form. And so I do think that, I mean, I'm just thinking about how right now courage is really contagious, and that can take a lot of different forms. And so deciding to be like, I'm going to cheerlead, amplify, and lift up the people in the broad tent that I might not agree with on other things, mm-hmm. when they are out there doing something that I'm like, oh shit, they said that. Mm-hmm. Like, right, there's no filter. Like, it's actually better for engagement, and it's better for building community and unity against the common threat right now if we are creating and amplifying permission structures for more people to speak out and be brave. And that's like what we need to do. And a lot of folks that are doing that are going to say things or believe things that you don't agree with. Mm-hmm. And if you just focus on sort of criticizing those pieces instead of helping the whole choir get a lot louder, it's going to keep giving them what they want, which is diminishing our share of voice mm-hmm. in the conversation. Mm-hmm.
I would say two really quick things, which is one, no permanent friends, no permanent enemies as we go into this next phase of having to build our coalition. You know, a quarter of Latinos listen to Joe Rogan. Not a quarter of his audience is Latino. A quarter of Latinos in this country listen to Joe Rogan. And the fact that he is speaking out and calling out the administration on immigration enforcement, I welcome that. That is a good thing because it helps create a permission structure for people to move away. So no permanent friends, no permanent enemies. And then the second thing is we have to really acknowledge where people are and feel. And I'm looking at this again from a Latino lens, which is one of the big takeaways from 2024 is Latinos really felt passed over. They felt resentful about how they were experiencing the world. And, you know, we're acting through their anxiety around economic and physical security. All that is to say, we have to speak to that and say, we know that maybe the last 4 years didn't meet your expectations, and we're ready to move forward, and here is our vision for that. And so really speaking to where people's hearts are and their real feelings and anxieties are, I think, are an important part to us moving forward.
I think I'd just say one thing that I think we need to like lean into more in the tent right now is 2026. I hear a lot of people talking about like, who's going to run 2028? And I think that's such an important conversation, but like the midterms are fast and furious. They're going to be here before we know it. And like, if we keep spending all this time being like, I don't know, is it Gavin? Is it Kamala? It's like, we gotta stay laser focused right now onto 2026 and still, you know, and then 2028 is going to happen. So that's my little pitch for like what needs to be going on in the tent right now.
Okay. Jessica, yeah. Wrap it up.
Okay. I told you I was singularly focused just in terms of meeting people where they're at. I think it's so important right now that we stop treating abortion rights like it's a controversial issue, that this is something that people disagree about. They don't. My favorite number, my favorite stat is 81%, 81%, and this is replicable in multiple polls. 81% of Americans don't want the government involved in abortion in any way, shape, or form. That is hugely popular, and our politics don't reflect that, and we're leaving so much aside, we're leaving so much at the door that we don't need to.
All right. Can I just that is the offensive narrative that we should be seeding and getting everyone behind because it is so popular.
All right, thank you, ladies, so much.
Thank you, Erin.
Thank you.